This podcast is brought to you by the RNIB Children, Young People, Families and Education team in partnership with Fight Against Blindness. It's part of the Emotional Support series. This information will be useful for parents, carers and professionals who work with children with vision impairment and may also be useful for young people themselves.
Hi guys, and welcome to the next installment of our podcast series on emotional support for children. My name's Laura McCauley. I'm from the Children and Family Services team at RNIB. Today I'm joined by Karen Hurst, my colleague in the children's team. Hi Karen.
Hi Laura.
And we're also joined today by Dr. Ian McCubbin. Hi Ian.
Hello Laura. Hi Karen. Thanks for having me back on again.
Great to have you back. So Ian, can you maybe tell us a little bit about your role and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist and I work at the Children's Hospital in Oxford. The work I do there is various things with various different groups, but part of my work is funded by a charity called Fight Against Blindness, or FAB. And that element of my work is to do with supporting children and young people who have visual impairments or eye conditions. Think about the kind of psychological well-being, how they're coping with the condition, how they're managing elements of the treatment, and just generally kind of supporting them to be as psychologically adjusted as is possible.
Fantastic. And Karen, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your role within the Children and Families team as well?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the Early Support Education and Training Manager. And as you say, working within the CYPF team. And a particular element of my role is to look at producing resources and guides, information for parents. And I know, as we've said, that sleep is an area that a lot of parents have a lot of questions about.
Yeah, absolutely, Karen. As you were saying, it's something that comes up a lot. On from that then, Ian, why do some kids with a visual impairment maybe experience more sleep problems?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those questions that kind of at first glance seems obvious, but actually the more you think about it, the kind of greater complexity that's there. To start off with, unfortunately, I'm going to have to do a kind of slightly rambling tangent probably. And the rambling tangent is kind of how sleep works, basically. So at a kind of reasonably simplified level, sleepiness and kind of getting to sleep is kind of moderated by two processes. So there's the kind of sleepiness side of it, which is to do with kind of how long you've been awake. The longer you are awake, the more you kind of build up a sense of being kind of sleepy. And then when you nap or you sleep, it's kind of reduced. I mean, it's kind of like a build up in a pressure cooker that's kind of, you know, the pressure is released by you kind of having a nap or having a sleep. The second part of that process is, it's usually called the circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm is kind of just like your body clock. So this is a kind of biological process whereby you try and synchronize with the natural world. So lots of inputs come into the brain through your body that mediate this kind of body clock, or that kind of change it or alter it or try and kind of synchronize it. One of the most powerful inputs that your body clock, the circadian rhythm responds to, is light kind of falling in the retina in the eye. Without enough input from light in the eye and from other areas that we'll mention in a bit, this body clock can get a little bit desynchronized. And what will happen is people's pattern of sleeping and waking will start to kind of uncouple from the kind of light dark cycle in the day. So you end up with somebody being perhaps sleeping most of the day and being awake at night. So the circadian rhythm bit, as you can probably guess, if part of it is moderated by light falling in the retina, people that have eye conditions that may relate to or interfere with that process can kind of, you know, have an impact. You know, they can have difficulties there. So people that have diagnoses like, you know, retinitis pigmentosa or eye conditions that more relate to optic nerve or retina or brain can have resultant problems with circadian rhythm functioning and kind of the body clock being a little bit kind of unsynchronized or knocked off. People who have different eye conditions that might be more to do with the cornea or cataracts or nystagmus or something like that, it's a bit less likely to do with that. Now, it's worth saying always, sleep problems are not uncommon in the general population. I'm sure most of us have a bit of a felt sense of that. You know, lots of people have problems getting to sleep. Lots of kids have problems getting sleep and staying asleep. I don't know about you guys. I don't get nearly as much sleep as I perhaps should do. So end of the time, it's not uncommon. Yeah. So there's that. But overlaid with that, there are certain things that will reliably cause more sleep problems. So if you've got a health issue of some sort, a serious one, particularly one that causes discomfort or pain, you're going to have probably more sleep problems or greater vulnerability to them. But also, if you have some health problem you have to take medications for, things like steroids are kind of notorious for upsetting sleep. Health problems might require being hospitalized now and again. Hospital environments are catastrophic for good sleep function. You know, there's doctors and nurses coming and going all hours, there's lights mm-hmm. on, there's beeping, there's people making noises. So there's a kind of, you know, a kind of Venn diagram here that, you know, sleep problems themselves are not that unusual. In fact, they're pretty common. Having health problems make them a bit more common, and then having certain eye conditions make them more common still. So we see it a lot in the service I work in. I'm not surprised that you guys hear a lot about it as well.
Yeah, we definitely do, don't we, Laura? It's quite a common question that comes up, and I think people... I think everybody sort of, you know, I think as a parent, you do expect that when you become a parent, your sleep patterns will change based on the fact that you will be dealing with a little human being who doesn't really understand what sleep is and how that all works. But in terms of the questions that we do get, Ian, what sort of tips might you suggest if parents seem to be noticing a development of sleep problems with their children?
Okay, so it's a vast area, sleep, and it's one that I think people are increasingly understanding to be as vast and complicated as it is. There's been a number of kind of fairly high profile books out in the last few years that try and unpack it and make it a bit more understandable for kind of all of us to get a grip on. Now, the sort of sleep problems we might see routinely could be kind of initiating sleep, so, you know, getting sleep. It could be staying asleep, you know, kids staying in their own beds and kind of managing to get themselves back to sleep when they're in bed. It could be nighttime wetting, could be nightmares, could be all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, first things first, you need to try and get to grips with the specific nature of the sleep problem that your child has. Now, there's lots of kind of not hugely technical, but often quite effective things you can do at the front end. There's a whole kind of area of sleep kind of information called sleep hygiene. It's a very odd phrase, that sleep hygiene, but it basically means is the environment, it's not to do with having a shower or getting a bath, it's to do with is the environment conducive to sleep or not. So is it too hot, is it too cold, too bright, too dark, too noisy, you know, is the bed uncomfortable, all sorts of stuff. So first principles, you know, try and discount all that stuff. Is your child's environment actually kind of as optimized as it could be for sleep? Also, with any kind of issue that a child presents with, one of the first things that we'd always think about is the developmental level. So, mm-hmm. you know, what is normal for a child of that age or that developmental level? You know, sometimes people might have an expectation that is a bit mismatched. So, you know, are they trying to get a six-year-old or seven-year-old to bed at 6 o'clock in the evening or 6:30? You know, so again, are there kind of easy wins there about, you know, just shifting the bedtime back by an hour or two, knowing that they'll be more able probably? Think about that two-stage process again. Like, you know, the sleepiness bit will be more kind of online by then. And in fact, the kind of circadian rhythm may match up better with kind of what's going on. Everyone knows about the importance of bedtime routine. You know, when Karen mentioned the idea of, you know, the little people, you know, the kind of small babies coming into your life and then having to try and manage their sleep at the front end. Everyone has a felt sense of, you know, you try and initiate some sort of sleep routine for that child, successfully or not, but it's super important. So, you know, this sleep routine for the child has to be like a good hour before bed to set them up for getting to sleep. So all the nice kind of sleep inducing sort of behaviors and associations you can get, you know, nice warm bath, kid getting into their pajamas, a drink of warm milk, brushing teeth, having some stories, having a cuddle, all sorts of low stimulation, sort of soothing activities that are just going to get the kid in the right headspace. And it's about, you know, the right sort of activities, but it's also about them being presented repeatedly at the same time that eventually that rhythm is sort of taken up by the kid. So they know kind of instinctively one follows the other. And then at the end of them, I'm going to be climbing to bed and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. No computer games. I do this sometimes myself, you know, trying to play computer games and go to bed. It doesn't work. It's a disaster. Exciting TV shows, no kind of Paw Patrol before bedtime or anything else that's too exciting. I mean, maybe a wee bit of In the Night Garden, you know, a little bit of Niggle Piggle before bed. Is that a favourite of yours, Karen?
It's reminding me of a time when that used to be part of the bedtime routine, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, see, it's sweet. There's some, you know, I don't want to be sort of militant, and the reality is most kids will have a little bit of TV, some part in that that sleep kind of routine, but just a bit of caution about not being for too long and not being too intense or too exciting. So getting all that kind of locked in kind of will help, and establishing that routine, mega important. If there's something that's disrupting that, then fixing that is kind of first principles as well. Part of that, though, you need to be really cautious about, I think, is the idea of making associations. So if you think about that kind of nice routine, what did I say? Sort of like, you know, bath, pajamas, warm milk, toothbrushing, stories, cuddle, I think is what I said last. So if your kid is being cuddled to sleep, you know, it could be very lovely for them. It could be very lovely for you. It's a very positive sort of attachment behavior, right? You know, it's pretty delightful. It's going to do them probably a power of good and really relax them. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, though, if they're always getting cuddled to sleep, if they wake up in the night, you may find that they need to be cuddled back to sleep again. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever the association is at night will probably be what they require, potentially, when they wake up in the night. This is not true of all kids at all times, but it's certainly something to be mindful of. It's kind of simple sort of behavioural sort of psychology stuff. So if they're being cuddled to sleep or being stroked or breastfed, having a dummy, having the famous you and the dream sheep, all these things, if they have them at night, at bedtime, they may need them in the night. So if that's proving to be a problem and they wake up in the night, think about how they can be phased out kind of gradually, so that association is extinguished, is a really sensible way of trying to get your kid to sleep better through the night. So do the simple things first, I would probably advise.
Yeah. So again, kind of having that, you know, routine is really important as well. I actually think some adults could probably benefit from that. I know I'm definitely taking some tips from myself.
Definitely. The switching off the screens before you go to bed as well is something I definitely need to think about doing as well.
Definitely. Yeah.
Ian, you mentioned that certain eye conditions can lead to issues with a child's body clock or their circadian rhythm. If you think that this might be an issue for your child, what help, you know, where could parents access help?
Yeah, it's an important one. And it's actually, I'm not going to lie, this is a real challenge. There's lots of children whose families I've spoken to that find themselves awake at kind of all hours of the nighttime, kind of just padding around because they don't have the same kind of hormonal or neurological prompts to kind of stay asleep. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the circadian rhythm, so the idea is the brain releases a hormone called melatonin from a gland called the pineal gland in the brain, and that kind of is the chemical precursor or prompt for you to kind of fall asleep. Now, if the light and dark falling in the retina is not giving the child that, what you have to try and do is establish a kind of, you know, kind of almost like a kind of broader pattern of cues to help the child become instinctively aware of what time of day it is. And, you know, it's when you get into the mindset of that, it's actually not that alien a concept. You know, if you think, okay, if I can't use light to determine what time of day it is, what could I use? Well, could I use meal times? Could I use temperature? Could I use patterns of activity and rest? And these are all the sort of things that we'd probably suggest trying to use. And this is a sort of medium to long-term process, right? If you're eating the meals at the same time of day, every day, if there are certain walks happening at the same time of day, little patterns of activity and then rest, if you're kind of manipulating the temperature in the room consistently, that's not the correct sort of word. I think if there's a schedule through which the heating is clicking on and off, the child is experiencing warmth and cold, again, that'll key them into the idea of we're leading up to bedtime and bedtime is going to happen. And you can see how that can sort of mesh in these potential circadian cues along with the sleep routine that we've already mentioned. You know, the subtle cues to the day telling you it's breakfast time, it's lunchtime, it's the afternoon, it's the evening, and then there's a lead-in of all these other parts of the routine kicking in, a more specific bedtime routine. And if you can get this pattern consistent throughout the day, you're more likely to have a child who's synchronized with a day and night cycle, and less likely to have a child who's starting to sleep through the day and be awake most of the night. But it's for some people, it's a constant challenge. You have to keep tweaking these things and work pretty hard at it, which will just kind of revert to not being synchronized.
It's tricky as well, because as we know, as children grow and change, you mentioned earlier about thinking about child's age and developmental level, they do change, and the amount of sleep they might need will change, but also things change in their daily lives that can interfere with different elements of their routines, just as a standard thing is. It is a tricky thing, and I think a key message is just parents sometimes worry, don't they, that what's happening in the here and now is always going to be what will happen, when in reality it's just about working and adapting and figuring out those little tweaks, like you've said. Ian, you mentioned earlier about what happens with children who potentially do wake up in the night, and those the things that have encouraged them to sleep are no longer there. So if you are a parent with a child who does repeatedly get up during the night and is getting out of bed, and that's becoming a bit of a pattern for them, have you got any tips about how that could be managed?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a couple of things that parents could try. Now, with kids who are kind of an age where they are getting up and out and padding around, or kind of coming into parents' bed and kind of disturbing them, or, just padding around the house or making noise, the kind of key process, I think, is to try and incentivize that child to kind of stay in their own bed. And there's different ways of doing this. I mean, if you think about the most effective way for one child, as you said, Karen, that may vary across the time span. It may vary from child to child, but you need to find a meaningful incentive for your child. And there's a way of doing that with what some people would call bedtime passes or nighttime passes, where you give the child two passes. Now, these can take the form of little tickets or little bits of paper with kind of, something meaningful drawn on or written on or kind of scrawled on by the child. It could be little stickers, it could be pictures of something, but two little kind of tokens, I suppose. And when they go to bed, every time they get out of bed, they have to surrender one of those. So from the point at which they are put to bed in the evening, the kind of clock is then ticking. So they get up, the first time they surrender one pass, the next time they surrender the second one. Now, in the morning, if they have any left, they can trade these in for something, some incentive. For some kids, you literally just have a jar of kind of healthy sweets, and they can take as many as kind of matches up to the tokens they have left. So, one per token, two per token, you can kind of negotiate that with the kid. For some, it could be more like a kind of sticker chart or reward system thing. You add on the number of passes you have in the morning to the ongoing total, and it adds up to, five equals, some sort of form of toy that they want. 50 might mean a trip to the, zoo or whatever,
So they can cash them all in at the end of the week, basically.
Exactly. And you say cash, some people just prefer
I see where this is going, yeah.
As time passes, the more children I see, they'd stop messing around with toys and sweeties, just give me kind of a quid or 50 pence. It's sort of capitalism in action, and I'm not necessarily against it if it's effective. Now, The trick, I suppose, with any sort of system like that is it has to be personalised, and you have to kind of get excited with the kid when doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's often sustained in large part by the parent's enthusiasm for and diligence with. And, if you can be as excited and positive and get them involved in decorating the passes or decorating the sweetie jar or the jar that the tokens go in at the end of it, that'll pay dividends with their engagement with the whole process. With kids who have very little intact vision, one of my colleagues had this terrific idea where he suggested using sort of essentially physical tokens. So two toys, little toys that they could trade in, and the toys that were used as kind of nighttime passes varied actually. So for a few weeks it was two certain little figures, or a figure and a bear, I think. Then eventually when the kid got bored of that, they changed it to two different ones. Something physical that they could hold. And again, it doesn't necessarily really matter what it is, as long as the kid is engaged with it, as long as they can sort of hand them over in the morning feeling proud of themselves that they've managed it, or one, feeling proud of themselves that they've got one left. Yeah. And feel excited and kind of rewarded by the thing that they get in exchange for it. So I think that's often worth trying.
That's a good idea. And just thinking then, if they do inevitably for the first couple of nights struggle and come down repeatedly with no tokens or toys to hand over, the fact that it's an ongoing process means that, okay, well, we can try again tonight. And it's not, because that's sometimes difficult with young children, isn't it? If they don't get that reward, then the incentive has gone. But if it's a carry forward, well, I'll give you them back now, go put them by your bed, we'll try again, you know, next time. That's nice. I wish I'd known about that when my kids were a bit younger.
It's worth kind of, you know, these things can always be tweaked a bit. And like, it's always about the engagement. It's always about massively upping the kids' motivation at the start, which is why you have to get super kind of kids' TV presenter level excited about this thing. You know, this is the best thing ever we're going to do. It's so exciting. It's amazing. And if you can do that, it'll obviously help the kid to really kind of key into kind of, this is going to help me. But if it's too great a task, you can play with the parameters a bit. If the kid is getting out of bed 10 times in the night, then two tokens aren't going to go very far. Mm. You know, do they have to have sort of, you know, five tokens, you know, so that they can think to themselves, okay, this is tough and a challenge, but I can do this. You know, there's a possibility of me having something left in the morning, or six tokens or seven. You have to try and kind of tweak it. Now, obviously, you don't want the kid then getting, you know, a pound per token in the morning and you're very quickly bankrupted. That's why a wee bit of kind of playing around with this stuff can sometimes make it far more meaningful. So there's always ways and means, I think, even with a kid that looks like it's going to be quite challenging for.
Yeah. Ian, what happens then if actually getting to sleep in the first place is actually the problem?
Yeah, it's tricky. There's loads of reasons why a kid might find it hard to get to sleep, but often it's a kind of little anxiety, attachment-y, maybe even separation anxiety thing that's driving that. And often the way to approach that is as a sort of what we think of as a sort of graded exposure or a kind of graded desensitization type process. So there's a technique that some people call the excuse me technique. And the idea of the excuse me technique is you're going to leave the kid. So you're going to say excuse me at some point in the bedtime process. Once the kid is in bed and kind of a bit relaxed, a bit chilled out, you then say, oh, darling, excuse me, I forgot about that thing. So the thing could be, I need to check on your brother or sister. It could be, I need to go for a wee. It could be, I think I heard somebody at the door. I thought it sounds a bit sinister, so maybe not that. I think I
promise I will come back.
I'll be right back. Don't do that. That'll alarm the child. But just what we're aiming to do is leave the child for the basically the limitation of their capacity to tolerate it. That sounds a bit wordy, but you know, in the first instance, maybe you're looking at a minute. You leave and you come back, and the vitally important thing is you come back. So you don't go into the other room and think, oh, they sound quiet, I'll leave them. Because what you're doing is you're assuring the kid that you're definitely going to come back every time and that they can be confident in that. They don't need to worry. Mm-hmm. And then once you've established that, you up the time incrementally each night, essentially, by small enough increments that they're not really noticing it. Now, kids are not daft. They're going to sort of perhaps slightly key into the fact this is a bit weird, keep leaving the room. But you can just kind of give them some sort of explanation of, yeah, you know, I'm getting a bit forgetful in my old age or, you know, whatever. There's just, you know, things I need to go and do, and reassure them that there's no big deal here. I'll be back. And you come back. And across time, what will happen is the longer the kid is left for, the greater the possibility that they will fall asleep eventually. And in that gap, it may be 3 minutes, it may be five, it may be 15. But the point is you're going back in each time, even at the point at which they start to fall asleep. I still recommend going back in for a number of nights to make sure they're still staying asleep, and they're reassured by the fact that if they're a bit dozy, drifting off, mum and dad come back in, or whomever their attachment figure comes back in, and it's reassuring them that everything is okay. I don't need to get panicked. I don't need to get kind of, you know, up again. It's all right. And the whole process should be a kind of relaxing and kind of reassuring one, and should hopefully give them the confidence that they can kind of settle in, knowing that you're going to come back eventually, even if it takes a kind of minute or two. So, you know, important thing, they need to be kind of relatively settled in bed first. So that's why the routine is so important. You're getting them into bed. Hopefully they are in the right sort of physiological, psychological state to be kind of close to kind of sleep. You know, they're pretty sleepy, they're pretty drowsy. And then, you know, you have to ensure that you're kind of coming back in with enough frequency that they're reassured that you will. But yeah, the excuse me technique tends to be pretty effective. The other thing that Karen wants to say, because you mentioned it a minute ago, or perhaps Laura did too, one of you mentioned the idea of we should all kind of be thinking of, you know, better sleep routines. Mm. I mean, it did remind me, like, there is the important part that parents play in this, right? And it's tricky because kids getting up in the night is profoundly irritating sometimes. You know, it's annoying. You know, it's the big day at work the next day. You know, you're going to talk to Laura McCauley and do the podcast with her and Karen. You want to sleep really well. And then some horrible child pads through to your room and tells you that they've, you know, had a nightmare or whatever has happened. But, of course, getting aggro as the parent is only ever going to make these problems more acute, particularly if you have a sort of frightened or upset child. And thinking about your own needs, you know, if possible, do you need to get a bit more sleep around this? Do you need to actually kind of get your partner or, you know, husband, wife, whomever, to deal with child tonight if the sleep issues are starting to get slightly on top of you? Do you need actually to kind of co-opt in grandparents to come and help? If you're doing the excuse me technique, it's reliant on you going back into, you know, a child. If you have another child or two more, you may need to have somebody else to help out with them. So parenting stuff is kind of important. And there's another thing I didn't mention that I probably should do before I forget on that. Many parents will be listening to this probably thinking, what about, you know, drugs? You know, what about the things that could be prescribed to help your child sleep? And there are certainly things that could be. I may be wrong in this, but as far as I'm concerned, usually in children, there's only two things that are prescribed in this country, and that's phenergan or promethazine, which is an antihistamine. And that's kind of not that kind of controversial thing to prescribe. It's not that kind of, you know, controlled a substance in the grand scheme of things. GPs prescribe that fairly commonly. The other one is melatonin, which those of you with good memories will recall is what I said, the pineal gland in the brain secretes to prompt kind of, you know, the circadian rhythms in human beings. You can be prescribed exogenous melatonin, you know, to give to your kids to adults, in fact, to help them fall asleep. Mm-hmm. Phenergan, I'm pretty sure you can get from GPs. I may be wrong because it's antihistamine. Melatonin, I believe you only get prescribed by medics, and I think probably paediatricians or maybe probably child psychiatrists.
I think that's right, yeah. In the UK, I think that's the case. It is actually only available under prescription. I remember an inquiry relatively recently from a parent who was struggling to get an appointment with a paediatrician for this particular purpose.
So it's kind of tricky to get hold of stuff. And I don't know, Karen and Laura, like what your experience is of people taking these drugs, because they can be useful for many children, but they are by no means a panacea. And actually, they both have to be used in very specific ways and for fairly specific purposes. So, for example, I know that melatonin it can be quite powerful if given at the right time, with the right timings to initiate sleep. It may be less useful in sustaining it in the middle of the kids waking up.
That's what I'd heard as well. I know Laura and I were talking about this. Both of us in our past work have supported on things like residential activities with children and young people. And we do find that many do come to these, and melatonin will be part of their medication that they bring with them. And I have heard in the past that it whilst it is often successful in helping children sleep, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that continuation of sleep. But I think you're right though, aren't you, Ian? I think medication is something that parents have a particular concern about. So as you've said there, just it's definitely something that you discuss with a medical professional, even the over-counter things. It's definitely worth speaking to your GP first before exploring as an option. It's interesting. I found what you were saying before about thinking about parental behaviour and the fact that sleep issues in children can have a direct impact on the, you know, the adults caring for them. It can cause, you know, it does have an impact on the wider family. And I know that one particular area that a lot of parents have anxiety about because of that sort of wider impact that it might have. And again, I think on the emotional well-being of children as well as the impact on sleep is bedwetting. Mm-hmm. Have you got any particular tips or suggestions about families that might be experiencing or that the children that might be experiencing bedwetting?
Yeah, I mean, bedwetting is a whole area in of itself, and quite easily could have a whole podcast kind of dedicated to it. It's a significant bulk of the referrals to the sort of paediatric psychology department here at the Children's Hospital will be to do with, nocturnal enuresis or bedwetting, to kind of give it its other name. I mean, first things first, like, it's much more common in kids than I think most people would predict. I mean, I don't know, Karen, if, like, and Laura, what your experiences are talking to parents, but the evidence varies a bit. But as a rule of thumb, kind of 10% of kids kind of around age 10 that still have some form, maybe not every night, maybe not even more than one night a week of bedwetting, but, you know, with some degree of frequency, right? So it's common, first things first. Now, you, Karen, I think you alluded to the kind of stress that it can cause and the association that it has.
It's the stigma, isn't it? You wouldn't find a parent being too worried to talk to other parents about their fact that, you know, that their child is having issues with sleep. But as you've said there, I was quite struck by that, up to 10% by age 10. I have a 10-year-old son, and I think, you know, it would be unusual to hear other parents asking advice around this because I guess of the stigma that exists around it.
Yeah, it's really tricky, and stigma and shame kind of go hand in hand, and shame is paralyzing. You know, if people are ashamed of something, then almost by definition, what happens is they don't talk about it. It becomes hidden, and it becomes something that they will do almost anything to avoid talking about, and often that unfortunately just serves to maintain what sometimes can be, you know, manageable problems, maybe even fixable problems. You're right, people don't want to talk about bedwetting, particularly in older kids, because they don't want to embarrass the kids fundamentally. You know, they know that, you know, that type of behavior is more associated with younger kids, and many age groups of kids, certainly in school age kids, knowing that you do that could be kind of a cause for bullying or teasing in the playground, and again, you know, a source of quite considerable distress for the kid and potentially the family. So there's enough complexity, I think, that if it's a problem that's sustaining through kind of, you know, into school age, it's worth talking to the GP in the first instance, and potentially worth being referred to a paediatrician just to rule out physiological causes, because there can be many, you know, there can be many different things that can have a knock-on effect and someone's toileting behavior, like nighttime wetting. So as always, you know, I'm always up for kind of quick wins and kind of, you know, doing the simple stuff first. You know, is the kid drinking enough water in the day of having nighttime wetting? So, you know, urinary tract infections, UTIs, can be a cause of all sorts of kind of waterworks problems. So is the kid drinking enough water, and are they going to toilet enough in the day? Are they allowed to go to the toilet in the day? Do they need a hall pass at school? If somebody who's a bit prone to kind of having problems, this would not be a bad idea. Would they be prepared to use the hall pass at school? Often kids aren't, because it'll bring scrutiny on that they're not comfortable with. Yeah. Can you work something else out? There's all sorts of weird and wonderful, you know, nods and winks and hand gestures and kind of all sorts of things that schools work out. So a kid who needs to, perhaps for some reason just prone to kind of waterworks problems, can regularly wee through the day, make sure they're drinking enough water, so they just have better kind of urinary tract health, which is going to help them. In line with that, also, you can get little reminders that the kids can set. If they're allowed to have a phone, set in the phone. If not, you can get magical things like vibrating watches that will kind of buzz in their wrist subtly, so they'll get a little prompt, go for a wee, you know, make sure you have good kind of urinary tract kind of function, so you're less likely to pick up problems like nighttime wetting. Obviously, there's old school stuff like wetting alarms. I say old school, I mean old school-ish, right? Bed wetting alarms have been around for a very long time and are not a very kind of sophisticated idea in some senses, but are actually a very effective way to help kids to kind of make the right sort of associations to going for wees at the right sort of time, again, to avoid the wetting happening. And of course, some people do, again, kind of fairly old school stuff. Like if a child, you know, pretty if it's a young one who seems to be wetting the bed at a similar time every night, and it's a time where the parents would be awake, can you go up 20 minutes before, scoop them up, put them in the toilet, half asleep, get them to have a wee, you know, get them back to bed, fall asleep again, and hopefully kind of, you know, head the problem off.
It's interesting, that last point there, that's something I used to do with my daughter, and I used to worry that doing that would interrupt her sleep, and it was that weighing up between what's the better thing to do, because obviously a child wetting the bed is very disruptive in terms of their sleep patterns, and obviously we're focusing on sleep here as well, but it's which is the not lesser of two evils as such, but which actually has the better effect of keeping that child in their bed longest. I know somebody once told me as well that if you are in a situation where, just again in terms of protecting sleep, if a child wets the bed, then it's very often quite a lot of fuss around that, in the sense that getting the child redressed, having to strip the bed, heaven forbid putting them in the shower and things. But a better way of approaching it is to try and, like you were saying before, the consistency of the bedtime routine. So low lights, quiet, try and keep the child sleepy, you know, just to maintain that sleep pattern. It does happen, I guess, but that's some really interesting advice there though. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah, definitely. So I suppose, Ian, in summary, I suppose the important thing, the kind of takeaway for parents for this is sleep problems, they are common in general, but they are common in some with some eye conditions as well. And there are ways to address these problems for kids.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think that's absolutely bang on summary. It's again, I come back to this idea of, you know, I visualize it as kind of, you know, like a Venn diagram or kind of overlapping circles. You know, the idea of, you know, loads of kids have sleep problems. Throwing extra things into the mix that could cause stress or kind of, you know, just interference with sort of psychological adjustment are going to cause more sleep problems. Any health issue that causes discomfort or pain or requires kind of certain medications will cause more. And there are a subset of eye conditions or types of visual impairment, particularly those that are to do with the retina and the optic nerve, that can cause specific types of kind of body clock, circadian rhythm dysfunction. But with all of the above, there are lots of things that can be done. And some of the most effective things are actually simple. It really is just about often sleep conducive sort of bedtime routines, getting the right sort of routine locked in, trying to have cues through the day for people if they have some sort of circadian rhythm dysfunction to key them into when it is and when the lead up to bedtime will be. And there's also like little tips and tricks and strategies, like we said, about, you know, bedtime passes, for example, or excuse me, or other things that can address specific issues when they arise. I mean, it is worth noting, and I think I may have mentioned it a minute or two ago, there's specialist professionals who work in this area in children's sleep disorders, and there's a pediatric sleep clinic here at Oxford Children's Hospital. If there are problems that are sustaining beyond a certain point, and you've done all the obvious things and all the things that we've mentioned in this podcast, see if one of these clinics is somewhere not too far away and see if GP thinks it might be a good idea to be referred there, because there are, you know, a minority, I'd say, of kids whose sleep problems can't be addressed in general practice or even within sort of general paediatric psychology departments or within CAMHS or by other professionals who are generally equipped to do this type of work and who would need very specialist input. And my experience of those clinics has actually been absolutely excellent. You know, I've referred them a few of my patients from the visual impairment element of my work, and actually they've absolutely put things in place which has turned around those kids' sleep, which has been, like Karen said, you know, it's not just improved the child's sleep, but it's improved the child's psychological well-being and the psychological well-being of the whole family, because, you know, everyone's suddenly getting more sleep. So it can be powerful stuff, and it's important to seek effective help if things you've put in place thus far have not proven to be effective enough.
Yeah. Well, Ian, we've come to the end of our time. Thanks again so much for joining us today. Hopefully, again, there's a lot of really useful information there for parents. If there is anything that you would like to talk to any of the team about, please feel free to contact the CYPF team, and one of our family support officers can provide a little bit more advice. And we should put, we'll also put some information below the podcast as well.
If you found this helpful, you can listen to further podcasts in this series. You can find additional information at rnib.org.uk/children or email our team directly on cypf@rnib.org.uk. You can also call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. And for further information on Fight Against Blindness, visit fightagainstblindness.org. RNIB, see differently.